Good afternoon again, everyone. In 1926, the author A.A. Milne wrote a delightful children's book entitled Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh and all of the characters in Milne's book are based on stuffed toy animals in the bedroom of the author's son, Christopher Robin Milne. The book has been translated into many languages, even into Latin. Winnie the Pooh, the book, holds the distinction of being the only book in the Latin language that made it to the New York Times weekly bestseller list in the top 10 selling books. When I was a child, my parents played the 78 RPM record of a narrator telling the stories about the adventures of Winnie the Pooh. We didn't have television during my early years, but listening to such stories like Winnie the Pooh allowed us to imagine the wonderful happenings, and it took us into another world of thought. The cast of imaginary characters with human characteristics included Piglet, the affable little pig who always walked around on his hind legs, and then there was Tigger, the ever-so-bouncy, extroverted tiger who bounced around on his tail, and then there was Eeyore, the woeful, introverted donkey who ate thistles. And there was Owl, and then the very nervous Rabbit. And, of course, the central character was the ever-hungry Winnie the Pooh, a caricature of the boy Christopher Robin's favorite stuffed animal, Winnie the Pooh, his teddy bear. These imaginary animal characters were always getting into one predicament or another. I recall a particularly poignant and tender moment, and I'm not sure if it was in the book or if it was in the Disney movie that was made about Winnie the Pooh. And there was a quiet time when Winnie the Pooh said to his best friend Piglet, he said, "Piglet, are you there?" And Piglet reached out and held Winnie the Pooh's hand and answered, "Yes, why?" And Winnie the Pooh answered quietly, "I just wanted to be sure." Don't we all want that reassurance to reach out our hand and be able to be close to someone, to have the comfort of a friend, to be able to know that someone is there, as in Winnie the Pooh's words, just to be sure. I've entitled today's message, The Value of Being There, although some folks may tag this as the Winnie the Pooh message. I first thought about this message over 30 years ago, and at that time I talked to people who were tired. Just tired, spiritually tired. They felt physically tired as a result. They didn't feel as though that they had any particular talent to contribute to the local congregation or the work of the church as a whole. They felt frustrated and somewhat isolated or alone. Well, at this time of the year, as the days draw shorter, our daylight hours become fewer and fewer. Soon, it will be winter time and we'll leave for work or school in the dark in the morning, and then we may get home after dark in the evening. In the northern states, a tier of states, about 500 or 600 miles north of here, there's even less wintertime daylight than we have in Arkansas. The days are shorter and the nights are longer. With the short days and so much time in the darkness, people tend to feel discouraged. There's even a name for the discouragement that people feel when the days become shorter. It's called seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, SAD. According to one study, SAD occurs in 1.7% of the population in Florida. Of course, there's a lot more sun in Florida. Doesn't happen too often there. And 9.5% of the people suffer from SAD in Maine and other northern states, as well as those countries that touch the Arctic Circle, such as Finland. Well, many years ago, I lived in another northern state, or actually I've lived in four northern states, and it was a lady that was so stricken by the seasonal affective disorder, SAD, that she rarely left her house. On average, about 6% of the people, if we look across the country, are subjected to this seasonal affective disorder. Another 14% have a milder form of SAD. This means that about 1 in 5 people are influenced by some kind of winter blues. Well, in the winter months, people can become uncertain about themselves and uncertain about others. They want to reach out like Winnie the Pooh did to his best friend and hold hands, knowing that his best friend is there and saying, "I just wanted to be sure." So today I want to examine some biblical references to people who had such thoughts of being unsure of themselves, and then we'll review 7 points as to what God expects of us to provide for our reassurance. The spring, summer, and fall holidays are an exciting time when people gather together for those special occasions. And then there's a 6-month period between the fall holy days and the spring holy days. Sometimes we get the spiritual winter blues when we don't have the reassurances of the annual holy days. And we may need reassurances from time to time if we're in a small group. Of course, we can look to 1 Corinthians 1:26, and that's the reference to not many wise men are called. If we read it, 1 Corinthians 1:26, for you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. And of course, most of us are not considered wise or mighty or noble. And so those who are called, as it goes on in verse 27, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and so forth. So in other words, we are called, but not so many that we can feel so grandiose about ourselves. I have a small flock of sheep, 1 ram, 5 ewes, and 3 big ewe lambs, a total of 9 sheep. And sheep are a flock instinct animal. They have a strong sense of security when they gather together. Sheep simply don't do well when they're all alone. They're drawn to each other. Jesus Christ referred to his church as being a little flock. We can turn to Luke in chapter 12 and verse 32. It's a simple verse. We've heard it before. In Luke 12:32, "Fear not, little flock, for it's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." The people that God has called out at this time are not gathering by the millions, but they consist of small groups of people who around the globe collectively add up to thousands of believers. All of the small groups everywhere in the church need reassurance within each group and between groups. The Bible records someone whom God called, someone who was definitely in the minority of belief at his time. And to make matters more difficult, this particular man and his wife were told to leave their home and move away, and they moved several times. They finally traveled many miles away from the land of their birth. I'm referring to Abram, later to be known as Abraham, and his wife Sarah. And the story of that is told in Genesis 11 and 12. Abraham did not have a congregation around to encourage him. He didn't have what we're blessed with right here. He had to rely directly upon God for his spiritual sustenance as well as his physical well-being, as we should as well. But ultimately, God blessed Abraham, calling him faithful and extending the blessings to us. We read that extension in Galatians 3:9, where God extended those, not just the blessings from Abraham to Abraham, but to all of us who were believers in the after the manner of Abraham. Yet Abraham knew what it was like to be alone. Yet he listened to God's instructions for his life, and God made him a spiritually and physically wealthy man. Scripture also records the history of another man who came along with Abraham from the land of his birth, Abraham's nephew, Lot. And we're going to turn to Genesis 13 in a moment. But Lot was blessed by being close to Abraham, and eventually Lot chose to depart from Abraham because Lot wanted to live in the city where there were lots of people, lots of excitement, lots of goods and services. But unfortunately for Lot, he chose the city of Sodom. We read that in Genesis 13 and verse 12. In Genesis 13 and verse 12, Abraham dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent toward Sodom. Now, Sodom area was a rough crowd. As we read on in chapters in Genesis 14 and 15, Lot and his household were kidnapped and taken away. And Abraham chased after them with his men and rescued them. Abraham was there for his family. When God decided that the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah was so great that those cities must be destroyed, Abraham, in Genesis 19, Abraham bargained with God to save Sodom and Gomorrah. But if there were only 10 righteous left in those cities, but As we know, there weren't even 10 righteous left in those cities. An escaping Lot must have felt the heat of the fiery destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. In 1980, I was living in Eugene, Oregon. At about 10:30 on Sunday morning of May 18th, a mountain 140 miles north of Eugene, called Mount St. Helens in the state of Washington, blew. It erupted. The volcano blew. The top one-third of the mountain was pulverized, was turned into volcanic ash. The ash was whitish-gray in color. The ash resembled a powdered glass and was spread westward across the state of Washington, blowing as far away as Minnesota. I know that because I flew to Minnesota shortly after that, about 3 weeks later, and maybe 10 days to 3 weeks, somewhere in there. And they said, do not, when you see the dust on your car in Minnesota, do not use your finger and write on the dust, because the microscopic powdered glass particles will leave your imprint on the car as an abrasive on your car. So the dust blew, or the mountain blew, in Washington, and blew and scattered over that area. People told stories, or a year later after that, I drove instead of flying to Minnesota, and I drove through Washington and up through Spokane, and I thought, in June, why are there still little snowdrifts that have receded in the ditches? And that curiosity got me so bad, I got out and went into the ditch, and it was the residual of the mountain ash that had come, and they had plowed it off the roads, and it was now washed into the ditches, and it looked like little tiny receding snowbanks all along the side of the road, because I just knew it couldn't be snow in June, as it were. People told their stories of how they survived the blast of Mount St. Helens. One church fellow who was camping many miles away told about the midday blindness that he experienced when the volcano erupted, where he literally could not see the hand in front of his face because the dust was so heavy. Some people refused to leave the trembling mountain before the volcano exploded, and they perished. A local t-shirt maker in the Northwest saw an opportunity to make a few bucks, so he made t-shirts that said across the front, "I survived Mount St. Helens." I don't know if you've ever seen those t-shirts, but then it would have been 30-some years ago. The back of the t-shirt, the front looked perfectly fine. "I survived Mount St. Helens." On the back of the t-shirt, it was tattered and full of burnt holes, as though the wearer had been running away from the mountain when the eruption occurred. I thought of the Mount St. Helens volcanic blast, and then I thought of Lot, who survived the destruction of Sodom by running away and leaving everything behind. Abraham likely saw the glow of destruction and sorrow of Sodom from afar. When we look out upon the horizon, we can see about 40 miles if the plains are level, or and before the curvature of the earth doesn't let us look past the 40-mile spread. But we can see the glow of lights in the sky from even farther away. As a boy growing up on the farm at night, we could look into the sky, and we could see the reflective glow in the atmosphere of the neighboring cities. The closest town to where I grew up was 7 miles away, so the sky over that town was the brightest. But the towns that were 9 miles, 12 miles, 14, 18, in different directions, could all be identified as to their location simply by looking at the glow in the sky as the light reflected above the city off the atmosphere. You could even pick out cities like 60 miles away, such as Minneapolis, by this huge, wide glow in the sky. And so it was with Abraham. It's reasonable for anyone to assume that there weren't even 10 righteous people, because on the cities, for Abraham to have assumed that, because based on the glow in the sky over the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, it must have given Abraham a heavy heart to think that his nephew Lot had also perished in the destruction. Likewise, how did Lot feel to be spared, saved alive when all of his neighbors perished in the destruction? Presumably the fire and the brimstone were all around him. He may very well have thought that he and his family were alone, that everyone in the region was destroyed. His daughters apparently thought that no one else on earth was left alive. In Genesis 19:31, they thought they were the only ones. There was another person who felt very much alone. The shepherd boy and future King David was on the run to keep King Saul from killing him. David was an outcast, seemingly on the edge of society. with the power of the state ready to pounce upon him at a moment's notice. And he felt down about it because he was on the run so much. Most of us are familiar with the 23rd Psalm and have memorized it. It's probably one of the most commonly repeated chapters in the Bible that people have memorized by heart. But they should turn to why the 23rd Psalm was there. If they turn to the 22nd Psalm, and I am going to turn to that. I wasn't going to, but I'm going to turn to it because the 22nd Psalm is one of the reasons the 23rd Psalm is in place. And in Psalm 22, David describes how he felt and how he felt surrounded and how alone he felt, but how he felt that it was very difficult for him to cope. He even felt that God had forsaken him. And in Psalm 22, "Oh my God, why have you forsaken me?" In other words, he felt very much alone. Verse 6, "But I'm a worm, not a man, scorned by men and despised by people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults and shake their head." And he talks it down in verse 13, "Many bulls have compassed about me. Strong bulls of Bashan have beset me round about." And the bulls of Bashan were noted. It was a rich cattle grazing area in Bashan. And if you can imagine being surrounded by Texas Longhorns who all had it in for you, that would be a rather difficult thing to face. I don't know how many of you have been to a sales barn and saw some of the livestock they have there when they're selling bulls, or even some of the wild cows for that matter, and they run them into the ring. And there's a little place where the auctioneer's helper has to hide behind a partition to keep from getting gored or smashed. And it's a good place not to be. So we know how David felt in Psalm 22 and how thankful he was then in Psalm 23 when he looked to God. There was another fellow who learned to feel alone, even though it seems that he had it all. And that was King Solomon. He had all the riches and the pleasures that this world had to offer, yet he felt empty. What was the use? In my notes, I put insert verse here. So you can go ahead and look that up. But King Solomon was very disappointed at the end of his life. He wondered, what was the use? You know, was it all in vain? In Elijah, the prophet, he thought he was the only one who was left after King Ahab and Jezebel were killing the priests. We can read about it in 1 Kings around 18 and thereafter. And hundreds of priests had been killed by Jezebel. Unbeknownst to Elijah, there were thousands of people who continued to be faithful, including Obadiah, who was the chief servant of Ahab's household. And, of course, there were the 100 priests that Obadiah was feeding in caves. And we read in 1 Kings 18 and 1 Kings 19 about that, and how they each alone thought that they were all alone. Elijah thought he was alone. Obadiah said, well, he was pretty much alone, except he did manage to save some priests off there, but he had to be very careful. And I'm sure there's many other examples of people who felt that at times they were alone, people who wondered how they could ever be used of God. And the Bible abounds with their stories. Jacob was on the run, first from his brother Esau, and then years later, he escaped the grasp of his father-in-law Laban. Joseph, we read about, was cast into a pit, sold into slavery, falsely accused, thrown into prison. In fact, it was many years ago, as a fellow said, well, if you want to remember the life of Joseph, just remember everything started with the letter P. He said, and you've got the entire life of Joseph just in line. He said, you just remember he was cast into the pit, he went to Potiphar's house. From there, he was thrown into prison, and after that, he went to Pharaoh's court, and then finally wound up in a pine box. And that is, and of course, the reference is they took his bones back to the promised land. So just with the letter P, you can remember the life story of Joseph. But he was in a terrible situation and had to have been feeling alone. Then there was Daniel, a captive prince of Israel, hauled away to a strange land, and yet he chose to worship God despite the law that forbid the worship of the true God. We have the example of the 11 disciples of Christ after the crucifixion, where they returned to their former occupations, be it fishermen or whatever. All of these felt the sting of discouragement, and they needed reassurance. As a young man, I was in Spokesman's Club with a fellow who was about 10 or 12 years older than myself. When he came into the church, his wife had left him, and she moved several hundred miles away with his daughters. He knew the utter agony of separation, the pain of coping with a more than difficult situation. 20 years later, I was going through an enormously heavy trial in life, and the agony of the trial seemed greater than I could possibly bear. But I dragged myself to church each week, and I started to feel a connection with Job, except that I felt like Job had it easy, except for the boils part. And when I came to church, there was one man who would come, and he would just stand beside me. He didn't say much. He just stood with me, and he was there. He didn't wave a magic wand or sprinkle me with pixie dust. He didn't load me up with advice. He was the friend that I had in Spokesman's Club those many years before, who had been through so much grief and misery. Just like the friendship of Winnie the Pooh and Piglet, my friend was simply being there for me. So now as I look back on those two times in life, first when my friend was going through that time, and I was a young man new in the church, I really didn't know how to help him. I didn't understand the value of simply being there. I didn't know or feel his pain. It was 2 decades later. When it was my turn to deal with great agony, my older, experienced friend was a great and quiet comfort to me. Well, many years have passed since then, and we still keep in touch from time to time, and I'm pleased to call him my friend. And through his example, he taught me the value of simply being there. And it's wonderful that he's still among us in church these days, many hundreds of miles from here. So now I want to go through the 7 points of what God expects of us on the value of being there. First of all, we are fulfilling an expectation of God. We are fulfilling an expectation of God. God says, I will never leave you nor forsake you. We read that in Hebrews 13 and verse 5. In the last half of Hebrews 13 and verse 5, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. That is repeated or comes from Deuteronomy 31:6. When Moses was 120 years old and he was shown the promised land from afar off, God assured Moses that the children of Israel would be able to enter the promised land. In Deuteronomy 31 and verse 6, this is what God said to Moses. Be strong and of good cheer. Do not be afraid of them. Actually, it was to Joshua at that time. Be strong and of good courage. Do not fear nor be afraid of them. For the Eternal your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. It was pretty scary to go conquer a new land with just the people that they had after all of those years of wandering in the wilderness. We can rely on God. His laws are for our benefit, just as God provided for the people that were going into the land of Canaan. And just as the writers of Hebrews noted that God will never forsake us. God provided laws for our benefits. He hasn't abandoned the laws of gravity. He didn't abandon the laws of inertia or other laws of physics. And I put in my notes, God did not abandon the tetrahedral bond of the carbon atoms into molecules, without which life would not exist as we know it. In other words, there are certain things that hold things together for which we simply wouldn't even realize it. So neither has God abandoned his spiritual laws. So here it is what God expects from us. And the first subpoint here is in Deuteronomy 5, verses 12 through 16. I'm just going to note it for reference because most of us have memorized it. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy, to keep it special. When Jesus Christ expounded on the law of God, he mentioned that first we're to love God with all of our hearts. We read that in Luke 10:27, and it's in each of the parallel gospels, in Matthew and Mark and Luke. But I picked the one in Luke because it has a tagline that doesn't appear in the other versions. In Luke 10 and verse 27, Christ answered and said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. That's the little tagline, those last few words. That does not appear in the parallel versions, but it does in Luke, to add more understanding that when we love God, we are to love our neighbors as ourselves. And of course, to show that we love God, we keep his commandments, not just the Sabbath. I would refer to 1 John in chapter 5 and verse 3. But when I started looking in 1 John, I says, oh my, let's just read the whole book of 1 John. It isn't very big. But if somebody ever says that it's not really important to keep the commands of God, all you have to do is refer them to the book of 1 John. In 1 John 5 and verse 3, for this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commands are not burdensome. So the Sabbath is an opportunity to show our love for God. In Matthew 22 and verse 7, and verse 37, I have that in my notes, is an opportunity for us to show our love and devotion for God. So there's many benefits to showing up on the Sabbath each week, which brings us to the next point. So point number two, by showing up at church each week, we have the opportunity to provoke each other to good works. I want to turn to Hebrews 10 and verses 24 and 25. In Hebrews 10 and verses 24 and 25. By showing up at church each week, we have the opportunity to provoke each other to good works. In Hebrews 10, 24, let's consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. Verse 25, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. Notice that the verse that says we should provoke each other to good works, one verse, I like the way the New King James puts it, because I think it more accurately conveys the instruction. And in the New King James Version, as compared to King James, it says, let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. And if you take a look at verses 24, these are tied together, verses 24 and 25, these are tied together. First is to stir up the good works by coming together, and verse 25, not forsaking ourselves together, and the provoking good works, those go hand in hand. In other words, coming together allows us to stir each other up. And sometimes we need that poke, that little extra oomph that we get from the Sabbath that God has reserved for our benefit. I can't help but wonder, is oomph really a word? But that little extra oomph that we can use each week. We have a situation where we can use it or lose it, whether it's physical muscles or spiritual muscles. The implication of this Hebrews 10, 24, and 25 verse is if we don't assemble together, then we're not in a position to provoke or stir up each other to good works. So, by showing up each week, we're in a position to help others. If we turn to Matthew 18 in verse 20, in Matthew 18 and verse 20, point three is by showing up each week, we're in a position to help others. In Matthew 18, 20, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them. We recall that Obadiah, the governor of King Ahab's household, was faithful to God and saved 100 priests in a cave. In caves, 50 at a time, and he fed them for 3.5 years. He was in a position to help others. Queen Esther was another person who was in a position to help others. She was faithful to God. She became the queen of the emperor or the leader of the Medes and the Persians, Ahasuerus. Now, to get an idea, this was not some two-bit tin horn dictator. This emperor or king was the ruler of the land from India to Ethiopia, which is a huge part of the civilized world at that time. Esther's mentor, noted that Esther was in a unique position to help others. Esther in chapter 4, verse 14, and the last half of the verse I wanted to call because it's often quoted when we find ourselves in a position to help others. In Esther 4:14, when Mordecai said, who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? The words of Mordecai should ring in our ears. Perhaps each of us is in a position to help someone. But if we don't know the needs of others, how can we help them? Simply by being there, we can come to know our church family and how we can help others, and how and let others know that we would appreciate their help. I would note that simply by being there, that and being here as a church and supporting the church and its programs and activities, we support the youth camps. And that draws people from beyond just our local congregation and beyond the congregations that we have. And just by being there, we are able to serve others and be a light for them. Point number four. By showing up each week, we raise our own level of expectation for ourselves. We raise our own level of expectations for ourselves. In Matthew 25, in verses 14 through 30, we read about the parable of the talents. And I'm going to turn to Matthew 25 and verse Matthew 25 and verse 14. Because the parable of the talents, we've read it so often, it seems that we sometimes overlook how it pertains to each of us. And he's talking, Christ is giving the example of a parable of explaining about the kingdom of God. And in verse 14, and again it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them, to his servants. And he gave one 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and to another 1 talent, each according to his ability, and then he went on his way. The man who had received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So also, and likewise, he that, did I skip something there? Verse 17, and he that had received 2 talents, he had gained another 2. Verse 18, but he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. Verse 19, after a long time, the Lord of those servants comes and reckons with them. And 20, and he that had received 5 talents came and brought another 5 talents, saying, Lord, you delivered unto me 5 talents. Behold, I've gained beside them another 5 talents more. And his Lord said to him, well done, you good and faithful servant. You've been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of the Lord. Verse 22, he that has received 2 talents came and said, Lord, you delivered me unto 2 talents, and behold, I've gained 2 other talents beside them. And his Lord said to him, well done, good and faithful servant, and you have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of the Lord. Then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew that you were a hard man, reaping where you have not sown, and gathering where you have not strawed, and I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the earth, and lo, here it is. What is yours? And his Lord answered and said, you wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I didn't sow and gather where I have not strawed. You ought therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received my own with usury or with extra. Take therefore the talent from him and give it to him which has 10 talents. For unto every one that has shall be given, and he that shall have abundance, and he shall have abundance from him that has not shall be taken away even that which he has, and cast the unprofitable servant into utter darkness. Now this was a parable, of course, and the reflection here is that Christ was explaining to people that we must use what we have, even if we perceive that we only have a little bit. Now the exciting part about it is, in the last year, we have had a wonderful opportunity, and everybody has been able to share those talents. And it's not something that we would have predicted, just 12 months ago. And that every single person here has been a faithful servant in the work of God and has become a stronger participant in the activities of the church. And indeed, we're all necessary parts of the body of Christ. We move on to point 5. By showing up each week, we provide strength to the spiritual mother, the church, making the church a place of refuge for others to come and fellowship. So point 5 is, by showing up each week, we provide strength to the spiritual mother, the church, making the church a place of refuge for others to come and fellowship. We read from time to time in scriptures that the church is referred to as our mother, and as members of the church, we're to provide for those who come to the church for refuge. The Apostle Paul describes this caring approach, this caring attitude, when he writes a letter to the church at Thessalonica in Greece. In 1 Thessalonians in chapter 2 and verse 7, he so eloquently and gently puts it in 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 7 when he describes his approach to the church members in that area. In 1 Thessalonians 2:7, "But we were gentle among you just as a nursing mother cherishes her own children." Well, as we know, a nursing mother has a very special relationship with her child, a loving care, a bond, and so too are we as church members to be caring for others. And we know that the church has needs and that by sharing those burdens, it makes a lighter load for everyone. Not just a physical burden, but our emotional burdens as well. We can be there as a gentle nursing mother, comforting each other. And that's a very close type of relationship that Paul described in that point. We go on to point 6. By showing up each week, we encourage others with our example. There are many ways that this can be described. One way that we do that is by worshiping God through our music. I was delighted with the psalm, with the songs today. In Psalm 13 and verse 6 was the one that I had written in my notes. "I will sing to the Eternal because He has dealt bountifully with me." In other words, we're richly blessed, and so we sing to God. But we sang, what was it, verses, hymns 59 and verse 30. We sang about Psalm 100. We sang Psalm 50. Today, there are many, many, of course, the psalm means song, so there are many references to the joy of singing and how uplifting that is. And so that is how we make a joyful noise, to the Lord. We can make that sound that is so good to God and that's uplifting, not just to praise God, but to encourage others as well. I know that during the week, when I am about my daily business, and I don't think I'm the only one, I will find myself humming a hymn, and then, without even thinking about it, that this verse, this hymn comes to mind, and then, you know, and just without even thinking about it, connecting the dot. Oh, that's, without, you know, without, and I haven't really looked to put the hymn numbers together with the verses so much, but I'm starting to do that more now so that I can say, oh, well, Psalms 58, or the hymn 58 and 59 are both Psalm 100 derivations. Oh, well, hymn number 30 is Psalm 50 and starting to put those together. But as we go around and as we live our lives, we carry that with us, that positive reinforcement of the song where we get something out of it, not just praising God through our song service, but the encouragement that we give to each others. After all, just singing the song all alone in our closet doesn't somehow have the same ability to implant itself in our memory, but by hearing it over and over and being able to share that joy together, helps to encourage us individually and helps us to encourage others as well. And then I have point 7. By showing up each week, we give less opportunity to Satan to influence our thinking. Perhaps this may be one of the most important points here. By showing up each week, we give less opportunity to Satan to influence our thinking. There's an old saying that idle hands are the devil's workshop. What would we do if we did not focus on the Sabbath each week? Would our activities take us away from learning more about God and His ways? Would we spend more time on the job? Would we watch more television? Perhaps we would spend more time with our school lessons. Maybe we would pursue sports activities or as a participant or an observer. Would we spend our Sabbath time focused on our own pleasures that draw us away from God? I want to turn to 1 Kings 11 as a premier example that was recorded for us in 1 Kings 11. And this is about King Solomon. And here's a man who had it all. He had riches, he had wisdom. In 1 Kings 11, starting in verse 1, But King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, the women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidians, Zidonians, and Hittites. And 1 Kings 11 and verse 2, And of the nations concerning which the Eternal said to the children of Israel, You shall not go into them, neither shall they come into you, for surely they will turn your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. Solomon's heart, although he had it all, his heart was drawn away by strange women. Now, let me explain for a moment that this does not mean that women were strange in the sense that they acted particularly odd, or that they had blue skin or horns growing out of their skull. Strange is the term that the Bible uses to describe those who are not followers of the true God. Notice verse 2 that the real problem is allowing strange influences to turn our hearts away from God. Solomon's weakness was women. This is recorded in the Bible so we can examine ourselves, because each of us has our own personal weakness that might tend to draw us away from God. Do we allow Satan to feed our weaknesses? And that, of course, means that just by being there for others each week, we can not only reinforce them and their belief in the true God, but we ourselves can be strengthened by God working through others to encourage us. The opportunities to depart from God's expectations are endless. In Job 1 and verse 7, And the Eternal said to Satan, this is at the beginning of the book of Job, And the Eternal said to Satan, From whence do you come? And Satan answered the Eternal and said, From going to and fro in the earth, from walking up and down in it. In other words, Satan is everywhere. He's going all over the place, causing mischief. He's not just sitting in one place waiting for you to take a ticket and come in and see him. And so he's going to and fro in the earth. We read then what he is doing while he goes to and fro. If we read in Revelation 12 and verse 10, we have an explanation as to what Satan is very busy doing. In Revelation 12 and verse 10, And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. Notice the last half of the verse, For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accuses them before our God day and night. Sound familiar to that verse in Job, where Satan was constantly busy going to and fro. And now we know what he was busy doing, accusing the brethren. And, of course, his accusations may be true, and they may not be true. And that's the terrible part. I really hate it when they're true, because he's going to trumpet it out. And that's very uncomfortable. That's why my brother told me that's why he got married, so he could learn his faults. Not the brother that was visiting here, of course. The one in California. And I'm sure he'd be uncomfortable if he heard me say that I told him that. What is the solution, then? In James 4 and verse 7, gives us this solution to prevent Satan from giving a Satan a toehold. And the solution in James 4, verse 7, Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Of course, drawing close to God means following God's instructions on a daily basis, surrounding yourself with like-minded believers. I recall many years ago, well, it has to be many years ago, Mr. Armstrong's observation that the way to get air out of a glass was to fill the glass with water. And so, too, can we resist the devil and his temptations by staying close to God each week, by filling up our spiritual glass of water. Because when we're filled with God's Spirit, we're better able to resist Satan. Turn to Luke 4 in verse 8. We can see how Christ rebuked Satan in Luke 4 and verse 8. And Jesus answered and said to him, meaning Satan, "Get behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." Jesus Christ recognized when Satan was working on him and told him to get behind him. One of the ways we're able to refill our spiritual glass each week is simply by being there. We should never underestimate the value of being there. In 1995, at the beginning of United, I was overjoyed to see so many old friends and acquaintances at our first big combined Holy Day meeting. Last August, I was visiting our UCG congregation in Minneapolis, St. Paul, in Minnesota. And again, I was delighted to see so many friends that I'd known for so many years. Friends who stayed true to the faith, and in turn, they were encouraged that they had had visitors, just as we're encouraged when we have visitors here. And I very much appreciated that they were there, that I had a place to go. The 7 points on being there. First of all, by showing up each week, we're fulfilling an expectation of God. An example of that would be remembering to Sabbath to keep it holy or special. Number two, by showing up each week, we can provoke or stir up others to good works. Number three, by showing up each week, we're in a position to help others. Number four, by showing up each week, we raise the level of expectations for ourselves. Number five, by showing up each week, we're providing strength to the spiritual mother, the church, making the church a place of refuge for others to come and fellowship. And number six, by showing up each week, we encourage others with our example, whether in song or in service. And number seven, by showing up each week, we give less opportunity to Satan to influence our thinking. Just as Winnie the Pooh asked Piglet if he was there, and Piglet reached out his hand, and Winnie the Pooh expressed a deep need in all of us when he said, "I just wanted to be sure." Let's reach out our hand to others, simply to be there for them.